After preliminary discussions between the monarchy and the leaders of the Parlement, the royal household then opted to leave the city on the 13th of September, 1648. So again, we see this familiar pattern, which we've seen in England and in other in almost the same time in the 1640s, but also in other parts of early modern Europe, which is that when the crown tries to shut down popular resistance by force, there are popular crowds which get together and force the crown into some kind of compromise, often driving them out of its own capital. Early in the year 1649, the royal household decided to up the ante. Having left Paris again, it recalled French armies fighting against the Spanish in Flanders and on the Rhine as well, and ordered a formal blockade of the capital. The Parlement of Paris reacted very strongly to this kind of intimidation. It responded by first of all declaring Cardinal Mazarin an enemy of the king and of the state, and by setting up a fund for the levying of troops. This was a virtual declaration of war against the monarchy, although I should stress that it wasn't actually framed as such. Many magnates, important French magnates, including the Prince of Conti, the Duke of Longueville, who was the governor of Normandy, declared themselves for the Parlement, and a whole crowd of lesser nobles now began to converge on the city of Paris. The Parisian law courts were soon joined by others in the provinces. You'll recall there were other Parlements in other parts of France. And many of these other Parlements also went so far as to raise armies against the crown. This was really a kind of resistance with which the crown hadn't reckoned. It was so powerful that the monarchy did agree to negotiate, and by the Peace of Rouen, which was signed on the 11th of March, 1649, the Parlement of Paris was actually given almost everything it had demanded. And it's interesting, the crown capitulates completely when faced with this kind of resistance. But despite what appears to have been a complete victory for the magistrates, the Fronde of the Parlement really, I think, ought not to be seen as a revolution. It fell very short, far short of a revolution. What seems like the radical potential of unrest in the Paris Parlement and among the other courts in the land was undermined ultimately by two structural weaknesses in the position of the judges. And one of these weaknesses, I think we can say, was political, and the other is probably better described as an ideological weakness in the resistance of the Parlement to the French crown. In other words, to put it very in capsule format, the risings of 1648-49 in Paris are really of a very different order and a very different significance from the risings of 1588-89 in Paris during the French Wars of Religion. Let's start with these weaknesses, and first of all, the political weakness of the Parlement. It should be stressed that the Parlement of Paris was not a parliament. That is to say, it was not a representative body in any sense of the word. It was a judicial body, and moreover, even as a judicial body, the Parlement of Paris wasn't really a truly national body in France. It only had jurisdiction over part of France. It was a large part of France. It was more than half of France. But nonetheless, it wasn't a court whose jurisdiction extended over the whole country. And it's interesting to note that the Parlement of Paris was, in fact, very careful not to encroach on the rights of its other sister courts in other parts of the country or to become too involved in their affairs. Moreover, although I think it's fairly clear that many of the demands of the Parisian magistrates did have implications for the country as a whole, the judges in Paris, the demands that they made were always qualified, or we might want to say tempered, by a concern with the corporate and patrimonial interests of the court as an institution itself, rather than the nation, whatever that might have meant at the time, as a whole. And this corporate interest of the courts, this overriding interest in their rights and privileges as an institution, this concern was even more true of the provincial Parlement, who displayed the same almost parochial concern with their rights and privileges. If that was in a sense the political weakness of the position of the Parlement, the ideological weakness was at least as important, if not more so, because I think it should be conceded that the objections of the courts to arbitrary taxation did raise fairly important constitutional issues. For the court to say, you know, we have the right to audit the accounts of the French crown and to veto new taxation, these are, you know, the constitutional implications of this are fairly ominous. Nevertheless, ideologically speaking, the magistrates never moved beyond a defense, and I think we have to call it a conservative defense, of the powers that the court had traditionally had. They were not forward-looking. They were not looking to kind of revolutionize the French constitution. The parliamentaires in Paris in the 1640s are nothing like the clerical radicals in Paris in the 1580s and 1590s who sought to rally the people against the king. What the Parlement of Paris was interested in the 1640s, in the late 1640s, was its own prerogatives as an institution. Indeed, it's interesting that not only was the sovereignty of the monarchy never directly challenged by the Parlement of Paris, But the one instance of a popular uprising during the Fronde, which was a short coup mounted by an organization called the Ormée in Bordeaux in southwestern France, that was actually opposed by the local parliament of Bordeaux. So again, we see this extreme reluctance on the part of these law courts to, in some sense, join with the people against the monarchy.